again.
Chewie. We're home.
I bypassed the compressor.
You were the chosen one!
Something truly special.
Congratulations. You are being rescued.
Revenge is not the Jedi way.
I am no Jedi.
The ability to speak might not make you intelligent, but we're going to try to prove otherwise. This is the Clashing Sabers podcast. I am one of your hosts, Brandon, and I'm here with my co-hosts. First, we have the gonky of the internet. It's... That's you, Devor.
Oh, hi, it's me. I don't know.
I mean, to be fair, you don't always go first, so...
Yeah.
You had to go first today because Drew is not here, and also we have a special guest on with us tonight, straight from the savage moon of Endor. It's our good friend, Mark.
Hey, I wasn't sure if I was going to be gonky, though.
I mean,
I don't know.
I think we should just assume that Devor is anything with a droid. It's the brand.
Yeah, all right.
Yeah, yeah.
That's okay. Fair.
That makes sense.
So welcome, guys, and welcome everybody who is taking the time to listen. We really appreciate you taking the time to join us. If you haven't already, please make sure you're subscribed to the network on whatever podcast app you are listening to right now. And if you get the chance, if you have the time, if you could take a second and leave us a rating and review, that would be a great way to share what we do here, because word of mouth is still the best and strongest way to share what we have going on. So we want to thank everybody who has already done that. And again, just thank you guys for taking the time to listen, because this is going to be a really, really fun episode. We're going to be talking about The Bad Batch Season 3. We're going to be doing our best and butts. And I am very much looking forward to this because I have no clue what these guys have on their list. So it's going to be a surprise to everybody. But before we get into that, let's talk about what we've been Star Warsing lately, because Mark, you have not been on the main show here in a hot minute. You've obviously been working on your amazing audio drama that was released on May the 4th. But other than that, like, what have you been Star Warsing lately?
Oh, wow. that has consumed a lot of my time lately. But in the research and recording of that episode, I have done so much Star Warsing. And that's in addition to just how well we've been fed lately. I mean, I just feel like there's been so much that's come out just in the last few weeks. But everything from, I went to see the Phantom Menace premiere on May the 3rd. Saw that Acolyte trailer, sneak peek. Then I was catching up with Tales of the Empire. So, I mean, it's just been a lot. There's been a lot to catch up on. And, of course, obviously The Bad Batch. So that's what we'll talk about tonight.
Yeah, it is. May is the time of year when they really just seem to let everything out. Like, we just get a flood of new stuff. We've got The Living Force that I'm reading right now. We're right on the horizon of getting the official release of Temptation of the Force. Like, it's this summertime, they really seem to take advantage of. Devor, for you, what have you been getting into?
So much like Mark, much like a lot of other Star Wars fans, this past weekend, you know, watched Tales on May the 4th, went to go see The Phantom Menace on May 4th. That was a lot of fun. In my continuing journey through the Star Wars movie novelizations, I finished The Last Jedi not that long ago. So yeah, I've been Star Warsing quite a bit.
How do you feel about the sequel novelizations compared to, let's say, the prequels? Because I think the prequels focused on expanding the stories a lot more than the sequel trilogy books. How are you feeling about The Last Jedi?
Yeah, I would definitely agree with you on that. I think both The Force Awakens and The Last Jedi ones, you know, they give us some things that aren't in the movie, particularly, you know, you get some of those deleted scenes back into the novelizations. But for the most part, they kind of hem pretty closely to what you see on screen versus the prequels, you know, Attack of the Clones in particular, that novelization gives you a lot of stuff that's not on the screen, either in the official cut of the movie or even in like deleted scenes. It even goes beyond that. I do think probably of the three, maybe Rise of Skywalker probably does the most in terms of like fleshing out some of that lore, because you do get kind of some of the stuff around like Palpatine's return and stuff. But I do sort of agree with you there that, yeah, compared, if you compare like the sequels to the prequel ones, I think the prequel ones do much more work towards like the world building and giving you some unique character moments.
Yeah, I feel like the prequel ones are like companions to the films instead of reinterpretations of them. I think Rise of Skywalker is the best of the sequel novelizations.
Because
of the Palpatine stuff, but also what they could do with Leia and her communications with Luke through the Force and things like that. Mark, have you read any of the sequel novelizations? I don't know if you keep up with the novelizations.
I don't keep up with as many of the novelizations, but listening to you discuss it, I'm now intrigued. I want to go back and read Rise of Skywalker.
Yeah,
because that
it's really
like,
good.
Yeah, that sounds like, I mean, especially the stuff with Leia, like they could do so much more in the story, in the novel, and so yeah, I'm very intrigued to read that.
It's definitely worth it. I know some people who would argue that it's better than the movie, and I think that there is some validity to that argument being able to take place. To be fair, Lindsay and I argued that the Solo novelization might even be better than Solo the movie. I don't know if I feel that way anymore, but sometimes if these things hit, they really can hit well.
Yeah, I'm familiar with the prequel novelizations, and I was just curious, as I was listening to y'all's discussion, it makes me wonder who decides what supplemental storylines or elements go into these novels, because I imagine, because of the different time periods they were written in, that there was probably a lot more freedom to flesh out the prequel stories in novel form than there was the sequel story. First of all, because there's probably less material to flesh out in the sequels, because they didn't seem to be as, and it's going to sound like I'm bashing them, but it doesn't sound like the story had quite as much intricate planning as say the prequels did.
Yeah, no, I think that's pretty fair to say. I do remember listening to an interview with Matthew Stover when he was on the Wampa's Lair podcast. Great podcast. If you don't listen to it, definitely go check those guys out. And he talked about meeting with George, and he had a 4-hour meeting with George one time to go over the script and the story and kind of what George's ideas for the novelization would be. And George would read over copies of the novel and, you know, mark out things that he wanted to get rid of. There was one particular thing that kind of made the novelization in a lot of ways, which was the sun dragon metaphor dying sun dragon metaphor. I can't remember exactly what it is in the novel, but essentially the story goes that thing, George didn't like the original interpretation of it because it made it seem like it was something outside of Anakin that caused his fall, and he wanted to make sure that it continued to be an internal struggle for him that was leading to the fall. So I know George was extremely hands-on with the novelizations of the prequels, so I would imagine most of them happened similarly to that, where the authors came with ideas of like, let's add this, let's add that. And it seems like each of the prequel novels kind of has a focus on adding to one particular character. You know, The Phantom Menace really adds a lot about, young Anakin's story, adds a lot of vignettes there. And Attack of the Clones, I remember, focuses a lot on Shmi's story outside of what we get on screen. So I imagine that's something that they had conversations with George about.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
That under George, he would have been the source for what they could include and not include, and because he's such a rich storyteller himself, he would have a lot of this, you know, a lot of supplemental storylines tucked away in his mind that he didn't have room for, you know, in the movies.
And George definitely has his opinions, and he's want to share them. So, especially when it comes to the stories he's trying to tell. How did you guys feel seeing Phantom Menace in the theater again? Because let me tell you what, I got all kinds of giddy when that long time ago came on the screen again.
It was so great.
It was
amazing. It was a lot of fun, and I saw it with a fun crowd. You know, people were like laughing and clapping, and I did have an interesting experience in that I took a friend of mine who is watching the Star Wars movies for the first time. I think I've mentioned him before. He has no experience whatsoever with Star Wars. And he's loved all the Star Wars that he's seen so far, but he did not like this one. And
no.
I kind of like, well, I mean, and he was so apologetic. He was like, I'm so sorry. And I was like, you don't have to apologize. Look, this is stylistically very different from the original trilogy, which is what he had seen so far. And, but I think I'm going to show him Revenge of the Sith, because I really do want him to see Anakin's downfall before I take him back to show Return of the Jedi. Cause I really feel like that showing it in that order kind of like provides that through line into Return of the Jedi. So you have a better understanding of who the man under the mask is.
Yeah, there's a lot of power to that. And I mean, the cool thing about re-releases like this is you get the opportunity to do that. You know, Amanda and I went together to see the movie, and there was a dad with his three daughters there, and they were huge Star Wars fans, and they liked my Ahsoka shirt and talked about how they're going through the Clone Wars together right now, and the girls love Ahsoka and stuff. And I know Lindsay took her fiance to see it, and it was his first Star Wars movie in the theaters. It was obviously these young girls, probably their first Star Wars movie in the theater, because they were probably too young when Rise of Skywalker came out to be seeing that in the theater. They were probably, you know, 7 years old or something along those lines. So I hope we get more opportunities like this to get re-releases. You know, I hope we get a 25th anniversary of Attack of the Clones and Revenge of the Sith and stuff, because it's a great way to provide an opportunity for people who might have missed it the first go round to be able to experience that, or the new fans that came in with the sequel trilogy, you know, this new generation, to go and see, you know, what it was like to see Darth Maul's double-bladed lightsaber on the screen for the first time, or hear Duel of the Fates through, you know, the surrounding sound you get at a theater. So I'm glad you got to do that. I'm not happy that he didn't like it, because, you know, I would have preferred that, but that's a really cool experience.
I will say that the Darth Maul double lightsaber moment was the moment he said, whoa.
That's cool.
So yeah.
I take that as a win. And I also just wanted to add that it's like to further what you're saying, Brandon, it's just great to see this movie in the theater again, because I literally have not seen it in theater since it was in the theaters originally. So, and it looked fantastic. I mean, the pod racing scene still holds up. It's still
an interesting
moment. So yeah, I had a great time.
I leaned over to Amanda at one point and I was like, I can't believe this movie is 25 years old and it still holds up so well.
Right?
Yes. I know. Crazy. It looks really good.
Devor, what was your experience like going to see The Phantom Menace again?
Yeah, it was just a lot of fun. There's something about the theatrical experience, and I think it's just a function of like you're in a dark room and you're just watching this thing and you don't have any distractions, or like you're not on your phone, you're not like there's not something else happening in your house or whatever, and you're just all you're doing is just watching the thing that's in front of you. And like that can be part of like there were moments, for example, like particularly on Tatooine, like some of the Shmi Anakin moments that, you know, really hit in a different kind of way, and I felt more emotional about them, like than I would be than if I were just watching it at home on Disney Plus. And I think it's something about that again, like you're just focusing in on what's in front of you, and there aren't any other distractions around you. So yeah, there's just like, I mean, I've enjoyed a lot of what we've gotten in terms of Star Wars TV in the streaming era, but like there's nothing like seeing a Star Wars movie in a movie theater.
Totally agree.
Yeah, it's another level, and I just love that you can continue to come back to these movies and find something new each time. Like, I've never been a Qui-Gon Shmi shipper in particular, and let me tell you what, that big screen shows you all the subtle movements.
They
really leaned into that a lot more than I realized, because I've literally only seen this movie like on the big screen one time when it was on its original release. And so this was only my second time seeing it in the theaters. And that stood out to me quite a bit. So I have heard, and this is 100% a rumor, so I'm going to emphasize that, but I've heard that some people have seen Cinemark start to post Acolyte 1 and 2.
Oh, yeah.
So,
what?
Yeah, so keep your ears to the ground for that, folks, because...
Oh, wow.
Let me tell you what, if you didn't get the chance to go see The Phantom Menace in theaters and see the Acolyte trailer at the end, if you're avoiding everything, spoilers for the next 60 seconds or so, they show an extended version of the fight scene that we get in the original trailer. And that's kind of the basis of it. And it was gorgeous.
Oh, man.
It was.
Wow.
It was absolutely
encapsulating. They knew what they were doing. They knew what they were doing casting Carrie-Anne Moss.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It's so obvious, and it's such a natural fit. I mean, if you're trying to go into it spoiler-free, it's not really a spoiler to consider the fact that if you loved her in The Matrix, you're going to love her in this.
Yeah. It looks like it's going to be an absolute ride, and it feels like it belongs in a cinema, which is I think the greatest compliment you can give a Star Wars movie, is that it feels like it belongs there. And there have been, you know, some shows that I feel like, you know, feel like that, and then there's some shows that we've gotten that haven't, and there's a spectrum of opinions about that. But this one feels like it's going to be the game changer that we're expecting it to be. And I'm really excited to see that. But we have another show to talk about, because our dear Bad Batch has reached its conclusion. Season 3 has wrapped up. We have seen the finale. We've seen what happens to everybody on the Bad Batch team. And we're going to talk about it tonight using our Best in Butts format. So if you haven't listened before, the way this works is we're going to each give two things that we didn't particularly like, thought could have been improved, or just kind of stand out as a major flaw of the season. And then we'll get into our two things that we really loved about it, we appreciated about this particular season. So, Mark, since you haven't been on with us in a while, I'm going to let you go first tonight and give us your butt number two.
I feel like maybe because there was maybe a rush to finish the story, maybe prematurely, I felt like some of the team got a little underdeveloped. We'll get into it in best, but I was really happy with the development of some of the storylines for other characters. But I kind of felt like, you know, Wrecker was a bit underdeveloped. There wasn't much for him to do in this season. I kind of feel like, I would say that overall, that's one of the things that stood out to me. And it's probably only because of the strength of the storylines for some of the other characters. Like, I was feeling so much for certain characters and just noticing that I didn't really feel the same way about the entire team. So I kind of wanted that entire team camaraderie to really hit in the final season. And it ended up being that my focus shifted a bit more on certain characters at the expense of other characters. So I don't know that that is so much a fault of the storytelling or the show as it is just perhaps the way that I went into this final season.
No, I think that's fair. I've said before, I don't think this was supposed to be just three seasons. I think it was supposed to be four, and so they had to condense things down. And we've talked about that in our group chat, too. And so it does feel like certain storylines had to take a back road, or a backseat, rather, to other things, because you had to spend a lot of time really getting Omega to her final destination, because she is our main protagonist. You had a lot of work to do with Crosshair and stuff. So I wonder even if maybe they had other episodes planned, you know, in between, where maybe it was more character focused on Hunter or Wrecker, who I feel are the two that kind of took a backseat this season. But
you feel that way about Hunter?
A little bit. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I don't see a ton of development for him, outside of reuniting with Crosshair, which happens early in the season. So after you get past that point, it kind of, to me, not a lot happens beyond him wanting to continue to protect Omega, which is not anything new. So
yeah, I see what you're saying. For me, it was probably Wrecker and Echo that I felt were.
Yeah, out. Echo was definitely missing in action for most of the season. I was surprised by that. Like, we got next to nothing until the finale.
I was surprised at how little Rex we got. I mean, for some reason, I really thought that Rex was going to step up at some point and just make a grand appearance at the end. In a way, it's kind of good he didn't, because that was obviously something I was expecting, so it would have been predictable, but it's just sort of odd, given that we know Rex's role in later in the timeline, that he didn't have more of a presence here.
Yeah, maybe you guys correct me if you don't agree, but I think we as a fandom kind of expected it to be a little closer to the Rebels finale, where it's everybody gets back together. So we get Gregor and Cody and Rex and Wolf and all of these characters coming back together to help.
I think a lot of people, were thinking along those lines.
Yeah. And so instead we get just the Bad Batch crew. And I personally, I'll talk about this a little bit more later. I thought the finale was great, but it is odd that those things were set up and then not necessarily paid off.
I'm pretty happy with how they wrapped up the team's story, but you're right, the larger clone story I felt like was rushed in a bit, that they left some stuff on the table for that.
For sure.
Yeah.
Because they provided some answers, but I don't know, in retrospect, they could have done a lot more, but they didn't have the time.
The finale does a really good job in terms of bringing the Batch's story to a conclusion. But I think if you look across the whole show, all three seasons, it's clear that the show had kind of more galactic aspirations that I think it reached for. But because maybe it wasn't given the runway that, you know, the story makers had originally anticipated, that it wasn't able to kind of do all that stuff. So there are these kind of storylines that, you know, like we get this little bit of like, you know, Chuchi and like the kind of proto rebellion, and then that kind of stops at a point. Then we have that whole little like we get to see Wolf again, and there he is with Rex, and that kind of stops there. And then like the ultimate fate of the clones, sort of writ large, it sort of ends on this sort of happy note of like, well, now, you know, we can choose whatever life we want. But it's like, yeah, fast forward, then you get to Obi-Wan, and then there's that clone, you know, begging for money. Like, well, that's not great. He probably didn't choose that. So, you know, like there are some of those bigger things where you're like, okay, I think I can see that there were, like, I can see the aspirations, but they just, I don't know that they got the space and the opportunity to get there.
Yeah, I would be fascinated to know what was going on behind the scenes, especially considering the fact that we don't have an announcement about another animated show coming out, which I think we kind of again, we're expecting some kind of announcement in the nearish future. And it's, I mean, I think maybe there's D23 this summer. I'm not 100% sure when that is, but
yeah, it's the summer.
Is it? Okay. So yeah. I wonder when we're going to find out about something new. We'll have to wait and see. So Devor, what do you got as your number two?
So my number two is actually something that we have kind of hit on already. All of my butts and my bests are kind of character centered. And my number two butt was really around Hunter and Wrecker. And it's sort of a season three point, but it's really also kind of a point about the larger show, which is that they by and large don't really have anything resembling arcs. You know, if you go from the first time we see the Bad Batch in Clone Wars season 7 and you get all the way to the end of season 3, you know, Hunter is kind of given, you know, an 11th hour save with that epilogue, but for the most part, if you go from that A starting point and you get to the B ending point, they're characters that are more or less the same. You know, they don't really go on huge journeys where, you know, their interior lives or like who they are as people changes in huge ways. They're more or less still kind of the same people. So yeah, compared to, again, other characters that we will no doubt talk about in the rest of this, in particular when we get to the best, they really did kind of feel like static characters. And I do kind of, I'm sympathetic to the ensemble challenge, which is like when you have several characters as part of your main cast. Like, for example, you know, like if you look at Rebels, like Zeb, for example, like he has his couple episodes that are kind of focused on him, but his character, you know, doesn't change a lot relative to like a Kanan or an Ezra or a Sabine. So I'm kind of sympathetic that like in an ensemble situation, some characters may get more spotlight than others. But I do think there is also, like, I'm thinking right now, like, not that long ago, we finished rewatching Avatar The Last Airbender. And, like, that's a show that does a really good job of having this ensemble cast. But then every character, you know, gets these moments to shine and you see the growth of every single one of them. So I do think it's doable, even when you have kind of a larger group of characters to do that. And so, yeah, I wish the two of them had more moments where we could see them, you know, grow and change and face some challenges and get into the end of the show feeling like, okay, they're really like they're fundamentally different than they were at the beginning of this show. But I don't think you really get that with them.
Yeah, I don't think you do. And I'm thinking about, you know, that comparison to Rebels, because I think it's the closest thing we have with the ensemble idea. And with Rebels, you had, like, this is a Zeb episode, this is a Sabine episode, yeah, this is a Hera episode. Yeah. But you also had, this is a Hera and Sabine episode, this is an Ezra and Sabine episode.
Yeah.
You had these relationships that were developed in particular, you know, episodes. And with the Bad Batch, you have that with Omega and Crosshair for sure. You have it with Omega and Hunter. But the Omega and Hunter one is more about Omega than it is about Hunter. The Omega and Crosshair one's a little more 50-50, but everything with them happens as the group. And so you don't get a lot of breakouts where you have a, you know, Wrecker and Hunter going and doing something, like we saw. We did see that this season with the Fennec Shand episode, but that was an action adventure one. They didn't do a lot to develop them as characters. So when they did do that, it wasn't as effective in developing the characters as we got in Rebels.
Yeah, I think one of the reasons I might not have chosen Hunter initially is because of his relationship with Omega, and she's such a heart of the show that any character that's close to her that she has a close relationship with, I naturally sort of feel like it's more developed, even though Devor makes really good points about how that he really doesn't change all that much. But you can really tell which of the characters the writers liked writing for, because there just are some characters that just soar with their storylines and others just don't. And I think they had a real missed opportunity with Wrecker, because on the surface, he's this very, like, what you see is what you get. He's not terribly deep, but there's a lot you can do with that that then goes against expectations or is subversive in that it's like, oh, I didn't know that Wrecker had this backstory or that Wrecker is, you know, has this side of him. So, yeah, yeah, there were definitely opportunities there to flesh those out, but the writers were very occupied with certain arcs over others.
Well, and there's a moment with Wrecker at the beginning of the season when Hunter is all gung-ho about going after Omega, and Wrecker says something in the nature of, last time we rushed into something, we didn't all make it out. I mm-hmm. thought that that was going to be this moment that started his development into being, we'll say, more emotionally intelligent. And it just didn't. It was kind of, that was like a one-off of, oh yeah, they're morning tech. And then it moved on, which I'll get into a little more later.
It's like they had to give that line to someone and they just gave it to Wrecker.
Yeah, yeah. But we will circle back around to that in just a little bit. With that in mind, my number two, I'm worried. Well, I'm not worried. I don't care. But I'm probably going to get some hate for this. I still don't like that they did not just straight up answer the Force question about Omega / the lack of necessity for Ventress in that regard. I like having Ventress back, but I wanted more of an explanation of why she's back. And I have a big problem with the fact that it wasn't necessary for it to be her. It could have been anybody else that was testing her, and so it feels like an unnecessary retcon. So they could still be telling future stories. I'm working off of just what we have right now, and I hope we do get future stories because I do love Ventress as a character and I am excited to have her back. But you brought her back in an episode to provide an answer about Omega's Force ability, and then you just didn't provide an answer about Omega's Force abilities. And so it just felt unnecessarily vague, and it kind of goes with what we were talking about before of how it felt like a lot of stuff was leading to something more and then it just didn't. That's how I feel about Omega's Force story. Like, I felt like it was something that we'd had hints of it all the way back in season one with her shooting the blaster in I think it was at Crosshair and knocking him out. We go all the way back there and think about the fact that does she have the Force? Is this why they're after her? And I do appreciate that they explain that her blood was a binder for the midichlorians, and we got an explanation there. But if you're not going to answer the question that everybody is asking with a definitive answer, then I don't think it's necessary for the story to continue asking it. And so I had a problem with that happening, and especially bringing Ventress back adds weight to attempting to do that, attempting to provide an answer, and then they just didn't. And that it bugs me.
Well, I hope you don't get hate for that, because I think that's a legitimate critique. I think it's fair. I hadn't considered that, but you bring up some good points. And if it is true that they sort of had to wrap up the series earlier than anticipated, then I kind of understand from just a creative point of view that they wanted to introduce Ventress because she was going to play a larger role in the series, but then the series later seasons got axed. But then they just didn't want to part with the idea of having her be in, you know, to bring her back. And so I can see why they did it. And also, we have to think about this in a way. So Star Wars animation has a way of leaving a series with unanswered questions that later get answered in other series. So they're not unaware of these things. And I mean, of all the things, we got resolution on the Zilla Beast, of all things. So they do pay attention to the unresolved storylines. And that's a very important one. And I'm like you, Brandon. I just felt like They were hinting so heavily at there being more to it. And I like ambiguity. I'm fine with it. And I don't necessarily need to know that she's Force sensitive. But like you said, when you have laid out so many breadcrumbs, it to me, would be disappointing if they don't at least attempt to address it later. And you don't bring back Ventress for one episode and then just you're done with her. I mean,
yeah.
There's no way this is the last we're seeing of her.
Yeah, and I'm definitely working off of the idea that this is all we're going to get of her, even though I don't believe that this is all that we're going to get of her. But I'm not going to judge off of futures that, you know, can't be predicted. Like, we've got to look at what we have right now. And I didn't feel like there was enough of a reason to bring her in particular back. And they made it clear that they were doing it in a way that fit with Dark Disciple. And they kind of, you know, alluded to it in some lines about her having many lives or whatever, however it went. But I just, I was satisfied with the episode. I really did enjoy the episode. I enjoyed what they did there, save for there wasn't the payoff at the end one way or another. And I had no bias towards Omega being force sensitive or not. I just wanted a clear direction in the story, and to leave it vague and then not even address it later on in the season seemed like it was a weird choice. So Mark, let's go ahead and circle back to you and go with your butt number one.
My number one complaint about the show is probably not something I have a lot to say about. I'm just going to gripe about it. The show is too dark, and I don't mean thematically. I mean, it is just too difficult to see at times. There were times in this series, I was enjoying it so much, but then there'd be a scene where I'm just like, I can't see what's going on. It's so dark. And I've become sort of weirdly obsessed with why that creative decision was made. And I've come to the conclusion, and it's just my theory, that it is a cost-saving measure. Because if they have certain scenes that are so dark that they don't have to render as much of it. And so, because I also noticed it in Tales of the Empire. There are scenes in Tales of the Empire that are very, very similar in the sense that there's such little light in the scene, and it only, I mean, in a way, it's creative and can work in certain scenes. But now that I keep seeing it again and again, I'm thinking that this is an animation cost-cutting measure, and that takes me out of the experience a little bit. I tend to get very focused on technical aspects of a show or a movie. I can engage with the story on an emotional and an intellectual level. At the same time, I'm studying the technical aspects of it. So I'm pretty good at doing both at the same time. But yeah, that was... I think it's just because the show ended up surprising me in so many ways by the strength of its characters and its story arcs that was the one thing that whenever it took me out of the series, it just felt like it was, I don't know, distracting.
Well, and I think they were paying a lot of attention to the lighting this season. When you look particularly at the way that they changed the lighting around Pabu and Mount Tantus, and how Pabu gets darker and Tantus gets brighter, and then in the end, you know, things flip. And it shows, you know, the ebb and flow. And even the episode with Fennec, like, everything was very hazy and brown because they're literally, you know, going through some murky waters to get the answers that they need. But I definitely think you could be onto something about it being a cost-saving measure, because they were obvious, like, not that they're not intentional about these aspects in any show that they make, but there was definitely a focus on how they did the lighting this season, and the story that it told across the season. And so to have episodes, like, I particularly remember that moment when in the finale when Wrecker has been... Wrecker's been hurt and Crosshair is saying he's going to go in on his own and stuff. And it was like, I think Hunter and Wrecker are there, but it might just be a rock.
Okay. The moment for me, the reason that this is on the number one top spot on my butts is that moment at the end where they're reunited with Omega on the platform. and, you know, Hemlock has plummeted to his death. I'm like, I can't see it. I can't see them. I could see the glowing glint, like the reflections in their eyes, and that was all I could see. And I was watching in a dark room. And yeah. It was just, this is a moment I want to, you know, really soak up in and enjoy. And it's still, I can still go back and watch it and feel that way. It's just, one of the things about the animation over the years that I have just loved is to watch how it's gotten so much better over time. And lighting has been a big part of that. Like the lighting.
Yeah.
Gosh, has just, I can remember there was that, I don't remember which season of the Clone Wars it was, but it was almost like night and day between seasons where it just suddenly, it was like, oh my gosh, the lighting is just immaculate and the animation is so rich and detailed. And it's just, to me, it's gone up ever since then. And this is the one thing that I feel technically is a bit of a stumble, but, you know, maybe I can get over it.
Well, we'll have to see. When we get another animated show, if the trend continues, we'll have to keep track of that, and we'll keep a little. We'll get Drew to make a spreadsheet about which episodes are dark, and I'm sure he'll figure out some formula to measure it. But until we get him to do that, Devor, what do you got for your number one?
All right, so my number one is something that Brandon touched on, which is one Asajj Ventress. So I liked, you know, if you look at that episode in isolation, like I liked having her back. For me, post Sith Ventress is the best Ventress. I love her when she's actually, you know, away from Dooku and she's kind of doing her own thing. So it was great to see her back and kind of see her having these interactions, and you get the kind of, you know, the kind of crabby older mentor with hanging out with this kid. Like some of those Omega interactions were really good. But at the same time, I sort of feel a lot the way that you do, Brandon, of I question her presence in the show. And I've seen two things online about making the case, I think, about why she, or like what her function is there. And the two that I've seen that have been most convincing is like, is that she's there, one, to reinforce this point about kind of redemption and second chances, you know, kind of plugging into Crosshair's arc. And then bringing home this point, or trying to reinforce this point about the ability to choose, and that like the questions around Omega's for, like, regardless of whether Omega is force sensitive or not, at the end of the day, she has the choice to kind of make of her life what she wants to, that it's not like her fate isn't destined kind of one way or another, regardless of the answer to that question. And while I do find those kind of interesting and compelling story ways to use her, I also think that, like, if you're going to bring that character in, particularly if you're going to go to the step of taking a character who has, up to this point, been presumed deceased, and now you're going to come out and say, well, she's not, she's back, I have to the story reason has to feel really, like, super compelling. Like, much more than just, you know, bringing in a character that's, you know, happens, like, it, you know, then like bringing in a Rex or something, you know, or like bringing in Ahsoka or something. Like, okay, a character that I know is kind of around the galaxy at this time and is doing things, like, okay, that's one thing. But if you're taking like an ex-dead person and you're bringing them back, like, I really have to be like, oh, it had to be that person and no one else. And I don't know that I was left with that impression. And instead, I was more left with the impression of, you know, something that Brandon, you and I had talked about when we did the episode with Drew about the Acolyte, about this feeling of like, of recently of, you know, Star Wars shows and media kind of seeding, the, you know, having things in there to seed not that particular project, but for the sake of another project that is upcoming. And that's kind of the impression that I was left with Ventress. I was like, oh, she is primarily here, not for the sake of the Bad Batch's story, even if maybe she does plug in some ways. She's primarily here for the sake of setting up other stories down the road. And that's something that Star Wars has gotten more comfortable with doing lately. And it's something that is sticking in my craw, and I will, I guess, will have to get used to it because they're going to just keep doing it. But yeah.
Yeah, so it's the possibility that her appearance was like a backdoor pilot for the next
project. That's what it feels like to me.
Yeah.
Like, I can see the in-story reason, like, the in-Bad Batch of, like, I can see the arguments for what she's doing in terms of advancing the, you know, the here and now story with the Bad Batch, but it doesn't feel like that's the number one reason she's there. It feels like it's maybe the number two reason she's there.
Yeah. And I, the way you said it, you know, it had to be her. It didn't have to be her. And that's the biggest problem with the whole situation is now, if we get the Quinlan Vos, Asajj Ventress, the Path show that I want, and this was the launch for that, we're having a different conversation. But until that happens, we'll have to wait and see. So I want to go back to something we also touched on a little bit earlier, and that was morning tech, because this was my biggest issue with the season is they did not take enough time to deal with tech or really any of their emotional issues. I just felt like things had to move at such a quick pace to get to wrap up everything that they could wrap up that we didn't do something like Rebels when Kanan dies and they take an entire episode to mourn him, and it becomes the driving factor for the Ghost crew going forward in that. And in the Bad Batch, it goes in the opposite direction, and it feels like they don't really even confront the loss of their brother. We don't see Omega telling Crosshair, so we don't see Crosshair's reaction. We get sparse references here and there, like the goggles, but it doesn't seem to change how they approach things going forward. We get that moment with Wrecker at the beginning, and it's like, okay, maybe they are going to change things, and then Hunter just kind of shoots it down and it keeps going. And it's this catastrophic loss for this team. You think about the fact that this team has been through the Clone Wars, and they are undefeated. They have never lost anybody, at least as far as we know. There's no, you know, Bad Batch other than the group that we have. And finally, one of them perishes, and it feels like it's just they move on from it. And they go, oh, you know, tech is dead, we're sad, but we have to keep going. And I would have liked to see, especially at the beginning of the season, like, take the time to really show that these guys are struggling, not just with the loss of Omega and trying to get her back, but the loss of tech and how the loss of tech is driving them to push, you know, towards getting Omega back because they can't lose another member of their team. They can't emotionally handle that. Like, there's so many directions you could have gone with it, and we've seen how successful that can be. There's episodes in the Clone Wars where we get to see that mourning. Like, season 7, they do a great job with Ahsoka, you know, mourning the loss of the clone troopers and the loss of the other Jedi. And you just don't have that here. And it just feels like either A, they had to cut it to get everything else in, which I think was a poor decision, or B, they thought it was a kid's show, and so they couldn't take the time to do that, which seems hypocritical when you consider that they did that in Rebels. So either way, the decision to not promote text, or not promote, but deal with text loss more throughout the season, just seems really lackluster.
Yeah, and we talked about this in the group chat, and I think maybe only Amanda and I were the only two that were kind of looking for these clues, but there for a while we were wondering if Tech was going to make a return in some very sad and unexpected way, and I think she and I probably watched it in a similar way, that we got a bit distracted by that. So I wasn't paying as much attention to the lack of Tech mourning, because I was half expecting them to pull one of those, guess what, he's not dead. And so in the moment, it didn't jump out at me. But now that you mentioned it, I think you've made a pretty good case for how that could have been addressed and how it's been addressed in other series. But for some reason in this one, it got shortchanged. There are lots of references to it You know, as you mentioned, the thing that Wrecker says, there is that moment that Crosshair talks about Clone Force 99 died with tech. You know, so they are.
That's such a good line. I was going to mention.
Yeah, it really is.
And I look, the goggles work for me because I'm a sucker for that kind of thing. So to me, sometimes those tiny moments were enough for me, but I totally understand where you're coming from.
Yeah, and like the goggles at the very end when in epilogue work really well.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
That should have been the coup de grace of everything. It should have been, this is the period on the end of the sentence more than it was. Instead, like, the most we see Omega really dealing with it is when she puts the goggles in the museum on Pabu. And that's, like, I feel like that's, like, halfway through the season. And that's the first time we're really seeing her deal with it. And then we don't see Crosshair deal with it until the finale. And if it had been they didn't do that because they were bringing him back, that is a different story that they're telling. But when they are telling a story where he remains deceased, it just seemed like an odd choice. Devor, did you have any other thoughts on that?
No, I see your point on that. I mean, it's interesting that, you know, across the season, the times when Tech's absence, you know, most regularly comes up is almost in kind of utilitarian terms, where they're like doing a mission like, oh man, if only we had Tech here, and like he could figure this out. And those seem to be the times when his loss is most acknowledged, rather than, you know, less so compared to like an emotional perspective in terms of like impacting the characters and the decisions they make and, you know, like how they're behaving and stuff. So, yeah, I think it would have been, like, especially probably towards the beginning, to maybe have seen Tech's absence or loss be a little bit like, not just like, oh, we've lost this guy who has a certain set of skills and now some of these missions are harder, but instead really see them like messing up, making mistakes, being off their game, and it all being a function of they've had this loss, but they're not really processing it. They're just kind of going full steam ahead and they actually need to stop and take some time and acknowledge the loss and then they can move forward. It's a little bit sort of like what Rebels does with Kanan at the very end. Yeah, I think that would have been good. And maybe, you know, to where we started would have helped give some of those characters like a Hunter or a Wrecker, give them some of those character moments where we get to see them grow. That would have been a good vehicle for doing that.
Yeah, Devor, you make a good point. And it occurs to me that maybe one of the reasons why, you know, we weren't given that sense of closure with Tech is that in a lot of ways, like especially when you reference how Tech was used in storylines, I feel like Echo stepped up and occupied the role Tech would have had in this season. And so in many ways, they had someone on the team who was doing that. And yet, they didn't really acknowledge that, like, that dynamic had shifted.
Yeah.
I just felt like it was a missed opportunity for Echo to say, well, I'm doing a lot of the things Tech would have been doing here, and just have it addressed again. It could have been a repeating, even if they didn't want to have, like, an entire episode devoted to, you know, his loss, they could have put in more references to it.
Yeah, and I think that's the biggest thing is it's the opportunity cost of it, because there was so much potential with storytelling. Like, it's not just that, like, I love Tech and I wanted more time spent, you know, with him. It's they could have taken it in a deeper direction, I think is the best way to say it, than they did. And I think that would have made everything that they were doing hit better. So that's my thoughts on that. So let's go ahead and get into the best, because this is I think we all pretty much agree this is a really good series and we enjoyed our time with these characters. So let's go ahead and celebrate some of that. And Mark, I'll throw it back to you for your best number two.
Okay. So if my number one butt was the darkness bothered me, my number two best is that I love the darkness in the show.
Shut up. Why? What?
Especially Oh, any of those scenes in the early part of the season where she's in Mount Tantus and it shows like her day-to-day living when Omega gets up every day and the things she has to do. And oh my gosh, I don't know what it is about Star Wars lately that is just making prison stories so good, because those were parts of the show where I was just absolutely transfixed to what was happening. Like, I just love the music. I love the pace. I love the sinister feel of it. They did such a good job of showing how menacing, like, and not even in like a cartoonish way. It was a very sophisticated take on what that kind of facility would be like to wake up in every day. And I just think that they just hit a home run in every aspect of the storytelling, especially in those early episodes. So that really, really stood out to me, because I've always enjoyed the show and been entertained by it, but I found myself this season just absolutely glued to what was happening. And that was new for me, because being that it had so many action adventure elements in it, there were times I could kind of half pay attention because, well, this is an action scene. But this season, there were more of those moments where I was just really enthralled with how they were telling a certain kind of story. And that was one that stood out to me.
I definitely thought you were about to like pull a Drew and have like a semantic argument about why the dark lighting was also a good thing. So
I can't compete with Drew in doing that. So I won't even try.
No, that, especially the premiere, like that was just so well executed. Yeah, it was great. You're spot on. Like it handled darker things, and you know, it's kind of one of those things where it's like, this is a kid's show, right? Like, because this is pretty messed up stuff. Like, we're experimenting on children and calling them specimens. Like, this is more Stranger Things than it is Clone Wars. And I thought it landed really, really well. Devore, you got thoughts on that?
Yeah, no, I think it really does a good job with that stuff. You know, you just referenced kind of the middle of the season where we get taken into the vault and we see that the Empire is, you know, holding and kidnapping these sensitive kids. And yeah, it's very unsettling. I remember when that episode premiered, or I think maybe it was a two-parter. It might've been one of those weeks of like going into Twitter and people talking about like, yeah, this was like really, you know, heavy hitting stuff that you're seeing what's being done to these children. And yeah, I mean, I think, you know, to a point, Brandon, you were just talking about, like, and I think this is something that we've talked about on this show, of like the importance of media targeted to children that doesn't talk down to them. And I totally think Bad Batch is a show that is, you know, it is targeted to that younger audience, but it's not afraid to be like, here, like, we're going to, in a still kind of a kid-friendly fashion, we're still going to like give you this very like heavy, heady stuff and, you know, deal with these kind of dark ideas.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, it does it, and it, I've always appreciated that about Star Wars, you know, that it handles these darker themes and darker ideas in such a beautiful way. But man, if you had told me at the beginning of the season that they were going to be experimenting on children, I probably would have believed it, but I don't know if I would have like, I would have been like, that might be a rumor. I wouldn't have been sold on that, but it really paints the Empire in a really evil light. It sells Hemlock as the villain just extremely well. So it was definitely the right decision to make. And even getting to see, you know, Hunter and Wrecker and go with Fennec and kind of really test the moral line, you know, like how far can we push this before we've gone too far in order to solve this? What sacrifices are we willing to make in order to get the answers that we need to protect Omega? And where is that line? Like, even though that wasn't a main storyline. I think that's an underlying theme that happens throughout the season that I really enjoyed, especially when you're bringing Crosshair back and he's somebody who has crossed that line and has now come back to the other side. It's like, where do we go when where we need to go is a really challenging place to get to is something that I found extremely interesting in the season. And even Omega at the end, you know, has to make those kind of decisions of, you know, letting the Zillow Beast out is a dangerous final plan. You know, like things could go really wrong there. You're setting a monster loose on a facility. Like you could just as easily die in that situation. You're putting these other kids' lives at risk as well. And the show doesn't spend a lot of time on it, but I think the ideas are there of you know, this group does a good job of knowing where that line is and knowing what they're willing to sacrifice in order to get to their end goal, and not in a negative way, not in a dark side way, but just in a that their moral compass is so strong that they know kind of where their chips are going to fall before they even fall.
And one more point on this darkness thing before we move on. And honestly, in the moment, I found it funnier than anything else. But like the number of like gnarly deaths in that finale.
There's so many.
Hemlock is shot like six times and one guy gets like a sword spear through him. Like, what's happening here?
And Crosshair gets his arm chopped off.
I was about to say, even the off-screen violence was shocking because, like, when that moment happened and they cut away, I thought, well, that's not going to happen. And then you see him without the hand. It did happen.
It happened, yeah. I thought it was one of those things where, yeah, like, you're going to get another angle on it later or something like that. But, all right, so, Devor, that goes to you then for your best number two, rather.
Yeah, so my best number two is Crosshair. I think he has such a great journey just across the entire show, but then even especially so in season three, where, you know, we start with him in that three-parter and he's on Tantus and you can see how dejected and defeated he is. Omega's trying to encourage him to escape and he's like, just leave me, like, get out of here. I don't deserve it. And, you know, he is sort of unwillingly kind of dragged out as part of her first escape plan. And then you see them kind of, you know, on their own. And it's this kind of tense relationship. Like, he doesn't really kind of like being around her. But then you kind of see his growth and he goes back with the batch and he's brought into the group. And then you have, you know, him taking them back to, you know, the titular outpost from season two. And you have that great little moment after he and Hunter kind of reconcile and apologize to one another, where he looks up and he sees the bird flying up there. And, you know, then you get all the way to the end where, you know, he's willing to kind of plan 99 it and sacrifice himself. And, you know, he's up there with Hemlock on the platform and he doesn't want to take the shot because he's afraid he might hit Omega. But then he kind of, you know, he is able to, you know, he has that whole struggle with the hand and is struggling to shoot. But then he loses the hand. And it's at that moment that he sort of finds his resolve again and he's able to rescue her. I think he has across the three seasons, I think, one of the best character arcs that we've gotten in Star Wars in the last couple of years. It's just really well done.
Yeah, I figured we would get around to Crosshair, so he's not particularly on my list. But that moment in the finale when he makes that shot, after missing the shot earlier in the season with the tracker, you knew that was going to happen, but the way that it happened could not have been more perfectly executed. I just really enjoyed his story. And looking at it across the entirety of the season, or excuse me, the series, like, Star Wars is about redemption. So I think there's always that underlying belief that the character is going to get redemption. But there were times with Crosshair I was very seriously questioning whether that was going to happen. And I think that says a lot to the story, or gives a lot of credit to the storytellers, because we're conditioned as Star Wars fans to believe that redemption is going to happen. And so to be leading to a redemption, but also have us questioning whether that redemption is going to happen, is just great writing, and a testament to that writer's room.
I want to springboard off of that, because I had the exact same thought. Because, you know, just like you said, Star Wars has conditioned us to think about redemption as a certain way. And one of the things I'll add to that is that it's conditioned us to think that redemption comes at a cost. That you can have redemption, but then you're going to have to pay a price. And so that's why that moment in the finale where Crosshair says, you know, it needs to be me. I need to go in and do this. I deserve this. Oh my God, that was just amazing. And the fact that the rest of the team didn't let him do it was also one of those moments that just really hit me. You know, because his, you know, this desire to do this as penance was just so achingly real. And this is such a sophisticated character arc. Devorah, I'm glad you chose it, but I also, like, I had several bests just in case that, you know, somebody took one of mine and I'd have to use another one. And this Crosshair story was definitely one of the bests as well, for the exact same reasons.
Yeah, it just works in every way, shape, and form. And he is probably the reason I would most go back and rewatch the series. Because I think there's still a lot there to explore in his journey. And to go from, you know, what we got in season 7 of the Clone Wars, where he's just the cool guy who, you know, cool sniper guy, to what we got is just, it's just really good. There's not a lot to say about it other than a job well done. Speaking of jobs well done, I think they did a really good job having the courage to keep Tech dead. Absolutely thought they were going to bring him back. The lack of mourning was one of the reasons why I did think that he was going to come back. But I think if they had brought him back, it would have distracted us and been unnecessarily complicated. It would have complicated the plot. It would have taken away the focus from Omega. I think it would have, there would have been all kinds of problems in doing so. And the fact that they brought back Ventress and called the episode The Harbinger made it feel like we're going that route. And I just am very grateful that they didn't, because death needs to have meaning, and Tech's death, it means something in this story. We see it in Crosshair, you know, being willing to sacrificing himself, talking about how, you know, Clone Force 99 died with Tech, and the other two having to essentially explain to him that that's not true, that they've just evolved. It takes a lot nowadays to keep somebody dead. We almost expect them to come back to life more than we expect them to stay dead. And I think that this was the right call to add weight to the experiences that they've all gone through, and through who they are becoming, you know, and especially having Omega take the goggles with her at the end and kind of continuing the legacy of Tech in that way is really, really cool. So I like that Tech's death, despite the fact that he was my favorite character in the series, and I hate that we had an entire season without him, I love that it means something, and that when we go back now and rewatch it, it won't be, but this is just the first time he died. It's going to be like, no, this is losing Tech all over again.
Right. I was more relieved that he didn't come back. You know, like I mentioned earlier, I was like sort of waiting for that other shoe to fall, not because I wanted it to happen. I was dreading it. like, please don't go down that route. Please don't bring him back. Because it just, like you said, you put it perfectly. There's not much to add. It's, you know, his death has to mean something. Sometimes it has to count for something in Star Wars.
Yeah, agreed. You know, I was also, you know, going through the season with trepidation, even all the way up to the finale, when you get that moment where Hemlock goes into where, like, the evil Bad Batch, you know, are being stored and, like, the helmet's being put on. I was like, oh, no, oh, no, oh, no, it's happening. And, yeah, it didn't. And I'm really grateful for that, because I think it makes that ending land even more, because you're like, okay, Tech gave his life. And now, you know, they're together and they're living, you know, they're kind of getting their happily ever after on Pabu there. And so I think it works in that way. And then, you know, going back to that point that I was making a little bit earlier about, you know, children's media that doesn't talk down to kids. I think, you know, having that point of, yeah, like, you're going to lose people and it's going to suck. And, you know, that's something that is just a part of life, and, you know, you ultimately find a way to kind of move forward. I think that's an important message, as opposed to like, oh, it, like, it's just temporary and we're going to kind of bait and switch. You know what I mean? So yeah, I'm glad that they stuck with it. I'm glad that we didn't get some sort of fake out with one of the clone assassins. And yeah, I think retroactively, the fact that the show ends on is, you know, a happier note that it does, I think going back adds even more weight to his sacrifice at the end of season two.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All right, let's get into our best of the best. And Mark, what is your favorite thing about season three of The Bad Batch?
It's sort of indicative of the entire series, but especially in this season, it's Omega. Hands down, I was the most invested in what was happening in the third season because of Omega. I just found it incredibly moving to see and watch her development. And it was clear from watching the series that this is where they wanted to go with her character. So I'm not going to say that it was a surprise, but the degree to which they did it was so impressive to me. And it really hit me in an emotional way. I mean, I don't have children, but I imagine that this would be the show that if I had kids, I would want to sit down and watch this show with them, because Omega is such a great role model for kids. Just like DeVore said, this is a show that doesn't talk down to kids. You know, it has this good way of showing the darker parts of life in a very sophisticated way that doesn't pander or is fearful of showing kids things that are too scary. But at the same time, it also shows, you know, Omega is their age, and it shows her taking the initiative, and it shows her being a leader, and not just taking the reins when she needs to, but she's doing this because she has learned from her mentors, and she gives them credit for that. And that through line in through the whole series, and especially how it is wrapped up in the third season, is my favorite part of the season. And I had said prior that I would just love to see Omega grown up. So when we got the epilogue, I teared up. I was just like, that's what I wanted. That's, to me, it was just the perfect way to end this story. And I hope it's not the last time that we see her.
I don't think it will be. I think that epilogue was set there for a reason, to indicate that we can have future stories with her for sure.
Yeah, I mean, I don't necessarily want her to go the Ahsoka route where she's everything, but
right.
Not that I'd, you're like, I'm a big Ahsoka fan, so I love Ahsoka, but I do feel like they have an opportunity to use her sparingly and effectively going forward.
Yeah, I agree. I think you might see her in a Rise of the Resistance the book, or no, Resistance Reborn, Rise of the Resistance is not a book. It's called Resistance Reborn, where you bring in all of these characters, and it's kind of a big ensemble of people you've seen in different media. You know, you've got stuff from the video games, from other books, from the movies, all kind of coming together in that book. I think that could be an avenue where we could see Omega in the future, where it's more or less a cameo, but a sustained cameo would be really interesting. And I appreciate that we know, you know, that she is continuing on the work of the Bad Batch in really fighting her own war by joining the rebellion. You know, she wasn't really a part of the Clone Wars, and so to me, that's her taking up that mantle, and that's part of her bringing Tex Goggles there is showing that she is continuing on the legacy of fighting for the freedom of the galaxy, which is what the Bad Batch were intending to do as they fought in the Clone Wars. So, Devor, thoughts on Omega?
Well, Mark took my number one best, so I can just launch right into that, because perfect. My number one best was also Omega.
Sorry.
Because she... Yeah, no, it's totally fine, because she really is just the heart and soul of this season and just this entire
thing. It seems we have experienced some technical difficulties. Now back to the show.
Talked about the great opener of the season where you get this kind of slice of life view and you kind of just see her going through this routine in Tantus and then, you know, engineering her own escapes, and like you see the way that she is, you know, She's making these things happen. She's a catalyst for a lot of things, right? She's the catalyst for Emery's turn. She's the catalyst for helping Crosshair evolve and kind of integrate back into the Bad Batch. You know, she's coming up with these plans, whether it's, you know, getting herself purposefully captured to help the team find Tantus, or it's, you know, her, you know, corralling these kids and figuring out the escape plans. And so you see her kind of evolving that way in terms of really being an active player, you know, in the story. And then just like her growth and kind of the admiration that other members of the team show for her. Like I'm thinking about in the finale when the Zillow beasts escape and Echo's like, yeah, like that's Omega, because that's what I would have done, you know? Yeah. So like you see the way that they're like, oh yeah, like she's good. She's learning from us. Like that's, you know... And so, like, that's really great that they kind of come accept her as, and, you know, as more of an equal, whereas, you know, you go back to the beginning of the show, and it's very much like, well, like, you're a kid, you got to stay back, you can't get involved. You get to the end of the show, and, you know, they have much more trust in her because she's sort of proven herself. And then, yeah, just the great epilogue. I mean, I even said this in our, you know, in our group chat, like, it leans into all sort of the, like, the kid going away to college tropes of like, you yeah. know, the dad with the dog and like, you need anything, just give us a call. We'll be right there. Like, take care of yourself. Like all that stuff. But it just works. It works so well. And I mean, it feeds into all of the Star Wars things with Luke, you know, with Ezra, with all these characters of, you know, growing up and stepping into a larger world and like making your own adventures and blazing your own path. And yeah, it's just, I could not make Omega my number one best.
I think the coolest thing about the journey for the Batch overall is because of Omega, they became much more equals.
In
the Clone Wars, it's very much Hunter is the leader. You know, he's the one talking with Rex. He's the one talking with Anakin. And you know, everybody else had their special skill. And even though Hunter has his skill, you know, his senses, it was really like, well, he's the leader. That's what his special skill is. And by the time we get to the end, really Omega's kind of leading the fight,
yeah.
You know? And it's really cool to see her journey across that whole time. And the way that she just always believes in people is something really powerful. And the way that that always pays off, I think, is a really good message to send to our world overall, but to kids that are watching this show in particular, that are growing up in a increasingly pessimistic society that looks for flaws in other people, to have this character who is not just a hero, but she is the hero of the series, but not in the way that you get a lot of shows with kids her age being the lead hero. There's some level of campiness to it. This is a very deep, like we've talked about, dark story where somehow this character continues to be optimistic and believe in the heart of other people, whether it's Emery or her family, and that's a great message to send.
I forget which character said it to who, but it was one of my favorite lines in the third season. So help me out here. Help me remember who said it. But it was, the question came up of, can they trust Crosshair? And somebody says, Omega trusts him. And that was enough for them. And I was like, oh, that's...
I think it was Wrecker. I think Hunter was still worried.
Yeah, I think it was.
And Wrecker said, yeah. And that was kind of one of the major steps for Hunter eventually accepting Omega. No, she's a phenomenal character. I had always liked her, but I feel like season three really solidified her as what this show has really always been about. And it was a great conclusion to her hero's journey arc. I was kind of playing around with the idea of like, okay, I know she went on a hero's journey, but what really fits each of these steps? So I was kind of jotting it down the other day. And I don't have it in front of me, so I don't remember exactly all of the points, but I realized like the first part of the hero's journey, kind of all happens in those first two or three episodes when she meets the Bad Batch. Then you've got a bunch of, tests and things. And then the majority of her story really happens in that third season, from kind of the going into the cave of Tantus, and the person that comes out is a reborn, new version of Omega that is ready to lead the Batch and has seen that even without everybody else around, her training pays off. And I think that's huge for her because all this time she's had everybody else there with her. She's functioned as a team. Now she's got Crosshair, who is, more or less dead weight at that point, who she kind of helps bring back to life, and she's leading the forefront and leading the fight to get out of there. And it's just such a powerful message. And that kind of leads to my number one, because I called this one sticking the landing. Like, I thought the finale was absolutely phenomenal. I enjoyed every second of it. I have said before, and I still stand by this, I would have preferred it ending in that fade to black, kind of like the family picture fade to black and not getting the epilogue. But I do also love the epilogue because you can have two things be true at the same time. I would have liked to kind of wonder for a long time, what happened to them after that moment? Who did Omega grow up to be? But getting the epilogue that we did and taking it for what it is, it's great. Like, you guys have referenced it already. Like, it adds a lot to the story. It's great to see her grow up and see what became of them. But even before you get to that point, everything in there works. Like, getting to see Omega being the leader of her own little team with the kids that she, kind of takes responsibilities for is amazing. Getting the return of the Zillow Beast is perfect, and I love how it speaks to and represents the Empire's destruction of nature on Tantus, finally striking back. And then probably my favorite moment is that moment with Crosshair being willing to sacrifice himself, because he's doing it for Omega, and it's just a great conclusion to his story to go from that. And then a few minutes later, we see him making the shot with his left hand, and he's leaning on Hunter to do it, and he's having to have the faith that Omega's going to make the right call, and everything that is really against who Crosshair has been in the show, is what he has to depend on in that final moment, and he does, and is just extremely well done. I have almost, I have no major complaints with the finale. I thought the action worked really well. I loved finally getting to see a clone rebellion. That was really cool. I liked, again, like I talked about, you know, earlier about Tech staying dead, but I also liked that we didn't get a lot about the CX troopers, because it just adds to the mystique to me of how dangerous they are. The story with Hemlock was great, and getting to see Crosshair get a level of revenge in that regard was really cool. So save for, you know, I would have liked to have, you know, more of a conclusive tie on things like Cody or Wolf or some of these threads we've referenced already. I was very apprehensive going into the finale, to be completely honest. I was really, really worried that there was going to be just too much to do in the final episode, based on where we were the episode before. And I spent the week legitimately worried, like, this finale has the potential, if they don't do it right, to completely ruin the entire series. And instead we got, one of the best episodes of the series. I do think the first, episode of the season is the strongest in terms of its storytelling, but I think the finale had a lot of heavy lifting to do, and it lifted it perfectly.
Yeah, I wish I had seen it at a theater. It was that good.
Yeah,
I just wanted to see it with a crowd. And Brandon, you mentioned the action. I've said this before, but I am so blown away by how good the action in this series is, just from an editing standpoint and the way that action scenes are choreographed. A lot of movies could learn something from watching how the action scenes are constructed in this series, because they're impeccable. A lot of thought goes into, you know, the staging and how you, like, what angles to use. And I don't know, there's just a flow to action scenes that I feel like a lot of media gets wrong, because they think it's about overwhelming you with stimuli. Like, you throw so much at the screen as you can, and hopefully it looks like a lot of action. But it's, this show really thinks about it. And it's very clear that the production level is what it is because the people making it care so much about what they're doing.
Yeah. The entire series is just, it's a lot of fun, you know, and the action is a major part of that. Like, the humor is great. The character development is great. But I think we often forget, you know, the role that the action plays in the story. And I've talked about how I think one of the skills that I think Filoni excels at is using fights to tell a story. And I would say for the majority of these, the fights and battle scenes and things that we get, they are legitimately a part of the story, and they're not just filling in the blanks of time in between character development. And I think that continues in the final episode here, and is really the icing on top of the cake for that. So any other closing thoughts on the Bad Batch before we wrap it up, guys?
I'll just say this real quick. I've just been surprised by how invested that I ended up being in these characters, because I thought they were a fun group of characters, especially when they made that appearance in the Clone Wars, which, when you think about it, was kind of the backdoor pilot for this.
Mm-hmm.
But
it legitimately was.
Literally was, and that's why the Ventress scene really starts to take on more weight. But yeah, I really kind of wrote them off in the beginning as being not as capable of telling as heartfelt a story as they ended up telling. So I think overall the entire series ended up being a very pleasant surprise, and it really just continues a very, very strong slate of storytelling and animation.
Absolutely, absolutely. And we'll have to wait and see what the next animated show is. I mean, I've talked about it plenty of times that more and more animated Star Wars has become my Star Wars. And I know we're getting a ton of live action stuff, and at the same time making the shift back to the movie theaters and away from streaming a little bit. But I hope that we continue to get Star Wars animation, because what George started with Dave Filoni, and Filoni has continued to develop in these writers and creators who, you know, Dave Filoni executive produced, you know, this series, but he wasn't on the day-to-day of it. This was the people that he trained really taking over and proving what they could do, and they proved quite swimmingly that they could do it. So we'll wait and see what that future for animation looks like, and we'll be here to talk about it here on the Clashing Sabers Network. Gentlemen, if people want to get in touch with you, Mark, I'll let you go first. If they want to find you, where can they best do that?
That's difficult because I'm not on social media anymore. But if you want to shoot me a message, you can always just email the Clashing Sabers email address, and I'm sure that Brandon will forward that to me. So that's probably
absolutely
the best way to get in touch with me.
And Devore, if people want to hang out with you, see more of your thoughts, or listen to more of your Star Wars thoughts, where can they find you?
All right. You can follow me on X at A Larger UPod. You can also listen to me over on Space Swifties, a Star Wars and Taylor Swift podcast that I host with my wife, the one and only Meg Dowell.
And if you want more Clashing Sabers, of course, like I mentioned earlier, subscribe to the network. You can also follow us on all the socials at Clashing Sabers. We're producing content all the time over there, whether it's on TikTok, Instagram, or over in our Facebook group. And if you like what we're doing here, if you want to support us, or if you want to support kids and the future of education, you can help support our nonprofit by going over to patreon.com/clashingsabers and joining there. 100% of the money goes directly to buying and shipping books to teachers and classrooms across the country. So every penny goes directly towards that. We don't cover our cost of production or anything like that for the podcast. It's 100% going directly to the kids. And if you know a teacher, or you are a teacher, or you can look up a teacher on the internet and randomly pick them for us to send a box of books to, go over to clashingsabers.net and you can nominate a teacher there. Just click on the three bars at the top right corner, and you'll find the form right there available for you. So we appreciate you guys joining us. Gentlemen, I appreciate you taking the time tonight to have this talk and to celebrate the wonderful Bad Batch. And with that, I will close with Bad Batch 8.
Hi-ho.
Almost got it in unison. Almost.
We were close. It was pretty good. I mean,
We were ready.
You were ready. You were ready.
Yeah.
I was listening to the Last Jedi novelization.
All Clashing Sabers productions are the intellectual property of the Clashing Sabers Network and ClashingSabers.net. All licensed sounds and images are the property of their respective copyright holders and are used for informational and educational purposes only. For more information on our nonprofit or to nominate a teacher, go to ClashingSabers.net. For questions or inquiries, please email us at ClashingSabersNetwork@gmail.com.
You're just going to walk away?